Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest. A very warm welcome to this latest edition of Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, how much clout does the EU have when it comes to climate change?
Unless China and India come on board with a new system, for example, of emissions trading or something similar, then the whole scheme is really not worth the paper it's written on because it will have no impact.
Also on the program, 5 years since the Dutch legalized euthanasia, we asked what has changed for doctors and patients. We head underground in Switzerland for the construction of the world's longest tunnel. We look into Europe's Arab heritage and hear if Esperanto is back in fashion. All this plus our latest quiz coming up on Network Europe. This week, coming from our studios in Bonn, Germany, I'm Barbara Gruber. We start our program this week in Brussels, where the world's climate experts gathered to discuss global warming. All agreed the poorest countries of the planet are likely to suffer the most. Rising global temperatures and sea levels will lead to flooding of coastal areas and drive millions inland. Higher temperatures will also lead to more heat waves, stronger storms and change crop yields, resulting in more famine and disease. So what is the European Union doing about climate change and how is it contributing to the debate? Here's our Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle.
Well, the EU is contributing, likes to think of itself as contributing as a global leader. And we saw some fireworks here this week because the European Environment Commissioner, Stavros Dimas, had a go at the Australians and the Americans, accused them of undermining the global push against climate change by failing to sign up to Kyoto. That produced a pretty sharp response from John Howard, the Australian Prime Minister. And rather unfortunately for Mr. Dimas, this exchange took place on the same day as the release of data resulting from the EU's own emissions trading system. This is a system of trading carbon credits, and this is designed to help reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But the results that were produced from Brussels this week were somewhat disappointing, showing that actually emissions were on the way up.
So how much discrepancy is there actually within the EU?
Well, within the EU, I think there's a broad political agreement that climate change is a very, very important issue. And I think this is one of the huge changes that we've seen over the last 2 years. Even a year ago, climate change wasn't really on the political agenda, let alone absolutely the top of it. Recently, we've seen the whole issue of global warming dominating a summit in Brussels, the EU committing itself to very ambitious targets of cutting CO2 emissions by 20%, one-fifth of carbon dioxide emissions to be reduced by 2020. The difficulty, as always, comes not with signing up to the big global picture, but actually agreeing to the nitty-gritty detail and deciding who will take the pain, who will cut their industrial emissions most, and therefore potentially risk their economic growth.
Are there any countries within the EU which are pace setters in terms of climate change?
Well, there are a number of countries which are doing well in different spheres of activity. The difficulty, of course, is that every country has a different energy mix. Some, for example, France has a very big nuclear program and likes to put the emphasis on nuclear power. Britain is looking again at nuclear power, likely to expand it, as are some of actually the eastern countries. Whereas there are other countries which are further ahead in renewable energy, in wind power and solar power, Spain being one of them, Germany being doing pretty well, and a number of the Nordic countries too.
Now, Stephen, the European Union is only responsible for roughly 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So even a 20% reduction of its emissions would not make a major difference to global warming. How much influence do you think has the EU worldwide?
Well, this is a crucial question, and this is where there's, in fact, a very large divergence between opinions here in Europe and opinions in the United States, or in particular within the US administration. The American government takes very much that view that actually Europe isn't the big problem, and that unless China and India come on board with a new system, for example, of emissions trading or something similar, then the whole scheme is really not worth the paper it's written on, because it will have no impact. Now, the Europeans take a different view. Their perspective is that somebody has to act as a leader here, somebody has to show an example, and that actually you can't expect these developing countries to cut their emissions if the developed countries, the prosperous and rich countries of the West, aren't showing them a good example. And that's where the debate lies at the moment.
Network Europe Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle on global warming. And on to another environmental concern here in Europe. One of the biggest contributors to polluting Europe's Alps are heavy vehicles carrying freight between northern and southern Europe. For many years, Alpine communities have campaigned to transport goods by rail instead of by road. In Switzerland, voters even approved this policy in a nationwide referendum. Now, as Deutsche Welle's Imogen Foulkes reports, construction of the world's longest rail tunnel is likely to change the face of the Alps.
Switzerland's Gotthard road tunnel isn't for the faint-hearted. A single narrow lane in each direction, ordinary cars dwarfed by lorries roaring through. This is Europe's freight on the move. Italian wine to the Netherlands or German cars to Spain. They all have to cross the Alps. Both the road tunnel and the 125-year-old rail tunnel are overburdened. The narrow Alpine valleys are suffering from traffic and pollution. But deep beneath the Alps, work is going on to improve things. It's called Alp Transit, a high-speed rail link from Zurich to Milan. Part of it, at 57 kilometres, will be the world's longest rail tunnel. To visit it, you have to join the tunnel builders in a rickety, open-sided train which plunges through the darkness.
We worked at the longest and the deepest tunnel ever built on Earth. We have about 2,500 metres of overburden. It has a huge weight. There are millions of tons.
Deputy Chief Engineer Albert Schmidt is understandably proud of his work, but he admits it doesn't always go to plan.
We have fault lines, which means the rock in these zones is completely destroyed. And in these situations, we have to stabilize the whole section. In a good rock conditions, we can manage to reach about 40 meters a day. And in very poor conditions, we reach only half a meter or a meter. So it's obvious that the tunnel costs more money and it takes much more time to get through it.
2,000 people are working 24 hours a day, 365 days a year on the Alp Transit project. When it's finished, the train journey from Zurich to Milan will take just 2.5 hours, faster than taking the plane. But above ground, local people, like Arthur Loritz, are worried the tunnel will bypass their communities.
The new tunnel makes disappear the Alps, actually. With Alp Transit, all the mountains disappear. It's just a big black hole and nothing else.
Arthur Loritz and others living along the tunnel's route have come up with a plan. Keep the elevators built for the construction site and use them to create a railway station to bring tourists to the region. They call it Porta Alpina, gateway to the Alps.
So we have the deepest station with the highest elevator in the longest tunnel of the earth.
All these superlatives cost money. The final price tag for the rail link is likely to be at least $15 billion. But members of the Alpine Initiative, a group which has campaigned for almost two decades to get freight off the roads and onto the railways, think it's worth every penny. Alf Arnold is the group's director.
This tunnel is not too expensive. If you think we are building it not for 10 or 20 years, we are building it for a century or more years. And when we were building the motorways through Switzerland, nobody was asking if this is too expensive or not.
Outside, the lorries still rumble by. So when it finally comes into use, the new high-speed rail link should not only change the face of freight transport across Europe, but protect the beauty of these alpine valleys and perhaps even unite communities which have for so long been divided by the mountains. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, in the Swiss Alps.
The Netherlands hit international headlines on April Fool's Day 5 years ago, not because of a spectacular practical joke, but because on April 1st, 2002, it became the first country in the world to legalize euthanasia. The new law legalized the practice of mercy killing within strict boundaries, and there was a considerable international criticism of the legislation. Radio Netherlands' Louise Dunn examines how this euthanasia law is working 5 years on.
30 years of debate and discussion preceded the judicial review of ending a life on request and assisting suicide, as the euthanasia law is officially known. Professor of Medical Ethics Evert van Leeuwen believes the law was long overdue.
It became clear that we should make things legal by procedures and not letting an amount of practice go which was driven by ideologies and not so much by professional standards.
Even before the law was passed, euthanasia had been practiced in Dutch hospitals and nursing homes. Bert Keizer is a doctor who specializes in care for the dying and chronically ill. And while he agrees that the new law was welcome, he says it hasn't made that much difference in practice.
The actual events around deathbeds, I don't think they have changed at all. But I think there's an atmosphere of quiet and confidence. People now know what they're up to. And, I mean, doctors and patients, and both of them now know in what kind of circumstances you can ask for it, in what kind of circumstances you can refuse it. And this atmosphere of calm creates a better deathbed in those circumstances where you would ask for euthanasia. So, yes, it has created a change, but not a terrible change, because the actual practice, the number of euthanasias, for instance, has not increased after the law was publicised.
One of the safeguards built into the law is that doctors are required to report any instances of euthanasia to a commission which will review their decision. Professor van Leeuwen has served as a member of this commission, and he believes it's a weakness in the Dutch system.
Before the act is done, we have a controlling situation in the fact that a colleague has to act as a consultant to both the physician and the patient, and afterwards we only have a review based on paperwork. And of course reviews based on paperwork are never watertight, so there can always be problems which are written down in such a way that nobody will see, or are written down in such a way that nobody can make a problem out of it.
Van Leeuwen also points out that it's odd for a doctor who administers euthanasia to then report to a commission, which may then decide to use that report as the basis for a murder charge. Nevertheless, though, he remains positive about the law.
Having this regulation, this type of law, is better than having no law at all, and it's also better than leaving patients in distress. What's going to happen, and what is my doctor allowed to do and what is he not allowed to do?
When the law was introduced in the Netherlands, many foreign critics were concerned that the seriously ill, especially elderly patients, would be pressured into ending their lives. However, Dr. Keizer is convinced that those fears aren't justified.
I would say against this that, on the face of it, it seems a plausible argument. But the point is that people who ask for euthanasia usually are in such desperate circumstances that, yes, they are under pressure, but not from their neighbors or their relatives. They are under pressure from their terminal suffering, because people are so ill that, yes, there's a lot of pressure, but not from their environment. It's the disease itself which drives them into a corner.
Dr. Bert Keizer, ending that report of Radio Netherlands' Louise Dunn. You're listening to Network Europe, a co-production of Europe's leading international broadcasters. For more information about the programme, check out our website at networkeurope.org. With exactly 2 weeks to go till the French presidential elections, many people are wondering, can Jean-Marie Le Pen repeat his 2002 performance? 5 years ago, France was shocked when the right-wing candidate Jean-Marie Le Pen came second to incumbent Jacques Chirac in the first round of the presidential election. Now, with high unemployment and tensions in the country's immigrant suburbs, observers are no longer ruling out a repeat of 2002. Radio France International's Nick Champeau reports from Paris.
I will make mincemeat out of the euro. Opinion polls are horse poo. Races are not equal. Just a sample of the comments Le Pen made this week. At 78, the controversial politician does not intend to change. He claims that all of his competitors belong to a system that is rotten with corruption, while he is the only real people's candidate.
Non, le Front National ne se nourrit pas des peurs.
The National Front is not exploiting people's fears. It is the voice of the people, the voice of employees and retired people, the voice of farmers and small entrepreneurs, the voice of young and old people, families and single individuals, males and female widows, and myself.
Le Pen still enjoys posing as a victim who is denied access to the media, which isn't true, the victim of a political plot to bar him from running. The convicted racist politician says he doesn't need to campaign much because events are tilting in his favor. Last week's clashes between police and youths in the Gare du Nord station in Paris, for instance. They have reintroduced the two I's, insecurity and immigration, at the heart of the campaign, Le Pen believes. I've always been ahead of my time, he claims. I'm the first politician to have blown the whistle over mass immigration. In political rallies, Le Pen often makes fun of his opponents, whom he says are copying him.
As the days go by, I will claim my toys back from Nicholas's bag. I will also claim my ideas back from Nicholas. And in the end, my bag will be much more attractive than his.
The centre-right candidate Nicolas Sarkozy has called for a Ministry of Immigration and National Identity. Sarkozy is making no secret that he is chasing the votes of Le Pen's followers, while socialist Ségolène Royal said that every household should own a French flag. Le Pen is convinced that in the end people will prefer the original to the copy. He is in favor of the préférence nationale, mainly giving jobs, housing, and social security to French people first. Le Pen's loyal daughter, Marine, is on the campaign trail for her father. Marine Le Pen leads the modernist branch that is keen to give her father's party a more presentable face. The fact that she is a woman also helps the party attract female voters because the Le Pen ballot is predominantly male. So this week, for instance, she went to a street market in Aulnay-sous-Bois, north of Paris. She also went to a food market in Meaux, east of the capital. Her 78-year-old father only concentrates on his TV and radio appearances. He has only organized a handful of rallies. Marine Le Pen says it has nothing to do with her father's age.
He has many appointments. He has a very busy schedule. So he is going to take part in public events, yes, but not too many, because his schedule is very tight.
At 78, Le Pen is still giving polling institutes a headache, because few people admit they voted for Le Pen in 2002, and few people openly say they will vote for Le Pen this time round. So the first accurate surveys will be exit polls on April the 22nd. Nick Champeau, RFI, Paris.
Now, Europe's Arab heritage is not something we hear a lot about these days. Since September 11 and the international war on terrorism, many observers would have us believe that Europe and the Arab world occupy opposing ends of a cultural, social and religious spectrum. But as Ingmar Carlsson, a Swedish diplomat in Turkey, advocates in his recently published book, Europe should reconsider its Arab heritage. We decided to take note and sent Radio Sweden's Azara Kiris to meet with the author in Stockholm.
Ingemar Karlsson, Sweden's consul general in Istanbul and a leading Swedish expert on Islam and the Arab world, writes in his book that the very foundation of Western civilization would have been lost if it were not for the Arabs. At the end of the 7th century, the Arabs, a power to be reckoned with, were influenced by the world around them. They were particularly interested in books and writings kept in the Aramaic, Syriac and Arab Christian libraries. There, they found works of Greek philosophers and writers, including Aristotle and Socrates, translated to Aramaic. They took those works and translated them into Arabic. And of course, in turn, the Greek classics were later translated from Arabic into various European languages. Had those works not been transferred to future generations through the Arabic translations, they would have been lost forever, and with them, the very foundation of Western civilization, says author Ingemar Karlsson.
Well, I think people in Europe are not aware of the fact that we always speak about our Greek heritage and that is the basis of European culture. But very few people know that without the translations that were made of the classical Greek works from Greek to Aramaic and then to Arabic and then into European language, we would perhaps have lost this completely. It was Arab scientists, and both Muslim and Christian Arabs, in Baghdad and then later on in Andalusia, who collected these Greek manuscripts, preserved them, and translated them into European languages. Without that, they might have gone lost forever, and we would not have known anything about Aristoteles or Plato or Galenos or all the Greek scientists. And that's something I think one has to remind many Europeans about. That we have more in common culturally than we tend to think.
You also mentioned that the Arabs have contributed in various fields ranging from medicine to astrology to maritime and so on.
They used these classical Greek works, especially in medicine, and then they developed it. And the Arab contribution, the medical science, is enormous. They were hundreds of years ahead of us when it came to how to treat illnesses, to diagnose illnesses, and to methods for operation, etc. Health hospitals were common in Baghdad already in the 9th century, with special divisions for women and men for different diseases, and they made diagnoses about illnesses that were not known in Europe until 400 or 500 years later.
Even the English language has been influenced by Arabic.
Yes, I think about 5-6% of all English words are of Arabic origins, and most of them, of course, come from Latin and from Spanish. And in Spanish, about 20% of the vocabulary is Arab.
Can you think of English words which have their origins in Arabic?
Yeah, you have safari. You have risk. You have a lot of bank terms, and you have a lot of vegetables, for instance, and also from monsoon. You have admiral, for instance.
Word admiral is of Arabic origin?
It's Amir al-Rakhl, the commander of the fleet in Arabic, and that Amir al-Rakhl became admiral.
How much awareness do you think there is among the Western world about the importance of the Arab heritage?
It's not very strong, I think, but it's a pity that the Arabs themselves have not been better to tell people about that and to promote their own culture, but they have been quite bad at that.
Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiras speaking to Swedish diplomat Ingemar Karlsson. And from Europe's Arab heritage, we move to another interesting cross-cultural phenomenon, Esperanto, a language that was invented 120 years ago by a Polish Jew. Cynics mocked it as an idealistic cult for linguistic weirdos. But today there are still some diehards lobbying for Esperanto to be the EU's official language. They argue Esperanto is perfect for the modern internet age without global barriers. Radio Prague's Pavla Hurakova has been finding out more about the small but vibrant community of Esperanto speakers in the Czech Republic.
Did you recognize the tune, or the language for that matter? I won't keep you guessing, it was La Espero, the anthem of Esperanto. The lyrics were written by the initiator of the artificial language, Laser Ludwig Zamenhof. Estimates of how many people speak the language worldwide range from 100,000 to 2 million.
Al amologis turtaquer. Silenta musk pri amsusures.
What you've just heard were the first few verses of the Czech romantic poem Maj by Karel Hynek Mácha, translated into Esperanto by Tomáš Pumpr. The verses were read by my guest, Petr Chrdle, the vice chairman of the Czech Esperanto Association. Esperanto in the Czech lands goes back more than 100 years. Individual enthusiasts were already promoting the language at the end of the 19th century, and in the 1920s the first clubs and associations started to emerge. In 1921, a World Esperanto Congress was held in Prague, and in the 1930s, Czechoslovak radio started airing broadcasts in Esperanto. The Second World War, however, put an end to this development. Petr Chrdle told me about the state of the movement today.
V Čechách je organizací více, právně samostatných samozřejmě.
There are several organizations in the Czech Republic, but the one with the oldest history is the Czech Esperanto Association. This was disbanded in the 1950s, but was re-established in 1969. In the past, we were able to tell the number of learners from the attendance figures of official courses, but now most young people are learning online. There are 3 courses for Czechs available on the internet. Around 1,000 Esperantists are members of organizations, but I cannot estimate how many people speak the language.
Kolik lidí zná Esperanto, nevím.
The word Esperanto itself means one who hopes. The goal of its initiator, LL Zamenhof, was to create an easy and flexible language as a universal second tongue to foster peace and international understanding. While today English seems to be firmly established as the world's second language, Petr Chrdle says Esperanto opens doors where English would be of little use.
No tak, s tím, že lingua franca je angličtina, bych trochu diskutoval.
For example, in Japan, only businessmen who studied abroad speak English. If you go to Japan or Korea, English is of little use to you. However, Esperantists have one great advantage. There may be few of them, but they are well organized. When I travel anywhere in the world, I contact a local Esperantist. They are all idealists, as it is not something you do for money. So automatically, they are friends. English won't earn you an invitation into a Japanese home. But through Esperanto, I have stayed overnight in so many Japanese households.
Jsem tam přespal, a to protože ti lidé jsou úplně jiní, no.
In the early 1970s, the Czech Esperanto Association had some 2,500 members. Their number has since shrunk to around 900, and the average age is rising. Petr Chrdle, however, is not afraid the community will die out.
Tak to se nebojí, protože mládež není moc početná, to musím přiznat.
No, we're not afraid we'll die out. Our youth is not that numerous, I must admit, because most young people prefer to pursue lucrative careers. That affects all clubs and all hobbies. But they are there and are very proficient linguistically. They meet each other, they start international families where Esperanto is the common language, and they give birth to children who are growing up as native speakers of Esperanto. So we are in no way afraid of extinction.
Kaj tio ĉi estis Pavla Horakova de Radio Prago kun la raporto pri Esperanto. And no, I'm not bilingual in Esperanto. Maybe I should check out one of those websites and start learning. Well, that's almost all we've time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here's our April quiz question. It was 95 years ago this month that the famous ocean liner Titanic sank. Some 1,500 people died in the tragedy, which ranks as one of the worst maritime disasters in history. But 712 people survived, and we'd like to know how many are still alive today. You can email your answers to us at contact@networkeurope.org or simply write to us the old-fashioned way to the European desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 prizes to give away and we'll announce the winners at the end of this month. I'm Barbara Gruber. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in.
Ein Synonym für lass 100 Blumen blühen, 100 schöne Web-Cyphers miteinander wetteifern. Esperanto, Antwort auf den kulturellen Bankrott. Musik ist Weltsprache, keine schnelle Geldmache. Escuchare Lenguaje, selbst bekannt auf wieder dem Biss wie Castro. Die erste Geige zu seinem letzten Tango. Esperanto, eloquente Definition. Schnelle Länderlingo zur Verständigung der Nation. Basiert auf Romanisch, Deutsch, Jüdisch, Slawisch. Kein Sprachimperialismus oder privilegiertes Bildungsadel. Esperanto, kein Manko, wenn ihr sie gleich versteht. Wichtiger ist, dass ihr zwischen den Zeilen lest. Euch unser Style beseht. Fühlt, was mein Input ist. Ich sei Lyricist, internationaler Linguist. Liliano, Soul Guerriero. Die Texte Parisane, der letzte Mohikaner. Amigo, amigos, estoy representando. FK Amicaro, Motto Esperanto.
Avec son